Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Chair Emeritus and Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute, here to discuss how banking is the make-or-break public utility that allows our world to operate. We frequently mention that the core problem with our money system is that our money is issued by private, profit-making parties, specifically commercial banks, who issue loans, which is how our money gets created, but demand more back than they give by way of interest. This private control of money's issuance doesn't reach everyone, and it doesn't create enough for the needs of society and its growth. Generally speaking, in withholding money from broader public circulation, our affairs get stressed and needs go unmet. The notion that money is a public utility is a rather new one in common parlance, but one being embraced by many as we are challenged to pay for the growing infrastructure deficiencies and social system failures that we see all around us. Well, today we're going to talk with one such private banker, Ivan Frischberg of Amalgamated Bank, another 100-year-old bank like the Public Bank of North Dakota, but this bank is one of only a handful of private banks that are driven by public service and community investment. It's a refreshing look at a private banking business model with a key difference in its bottom line. Later on in the program, we'll be taking a look at another form of public service banking, CDFIs, Community Development Financial Institutions, those agencies that are dedicated to moving money into community projects that most private banks don't serve. They are on the front lines of community lending. And we'll be talking with Rainier Valley CDFI's Executive Director, Wayne Lau. And finally today, we're going to be hearing a stirring critique of Alexander Hamilton and the Broadway show of the same name with our resident monetary historian, philologist, and theater critic, Bob Bowes. And now, it's time for us to talk to Ellen with some thoughts about the matter of infrastructure financing and the push toward privatization.
So, Ellen, in the world of, how would you say, the machinations of the money masters, we've seen some interesting developments. On this week's program, we're talking with people about infrastructure and financing for needed projects. With the new proposed budget apparently is going to be putting a lot of weight on the states and the cities, moving things toward privatization, acting like the feds are really not going to be very helpful at all. The aspect of money being a utility that the economy needs is really not even in the picture. Are you seeing it kind of like that?
Right. Well, I read in an article about the Indian banks. Their banks are mostly publicly owned, although now they have some private investors, which means they have to be profit-driven or be oriented toward profits. And so the point of this article was that we need the public banks in order to serve the public interest. Banking is a public utility. Well, in the U.S., we have none of that. We have no banking that's geared toward serving the public interest. I mean, you could say theoretically the Federal Reserve, but we all know they are geared to serving the big banks. That's who they respond to. They call themselves an independent central bank, like independent of government, which means they're not there to serve the government, and the government is theoretically there to serve us. Mm-hmm. So nobody is serving, there's no banking system that serves the public interest, and that's what we need. And there's no banking system that's getting liquidity out there for the people. So we had quantitative easing, but where did that money go? The actual money only went to the reserve accounts of banks, which meant that so it didn't go into the real economy. It meant that they could make more loans, But who do they make the loans to? They make loans to their cronies. The good deals, the ones that get the good loans, are the ones that already have assets that they can post. So it's the local economy and the workers, the people without assets, the people that the consumers that need to get money in their hands if you want to have a consumer economy. If you want to get the wheels of productivity turning, you've got to have some buyers. And those buyers don't have money in their hands. So,
yeah. And in India, the drive to make India's public banks, mostly owned by public
banks. Yeah, majority entities, publicly owned. In other words, they're majority owned by the government.
They used to be privately owned. And hundreds and hundreds of them went down in disaster by the greedy operations of the privateers who ran the banks. So they nationalized the Indian banks and made them partially owned by public entities. Now, because the people who are managing the public banks in India have made some bad calls and there have been a bunch of self-serving deals, now it seems like the hyenas or the wolves of the privateers are saying, hey, our banks would be a lot more profitable and a lot more sustainable if we would give it back to private parties. and it's very interesting to see how they're using the United States as an example of why we don't want to do that. Because they said, have you looked at the U.S. banks? In the last 10, 15 years, we've had 500 bank failures in the United States. You know, here again, we come back to this idea that banks need to be public utilities.
And right now we have the Federal Reserve tightening, which means they're raising interest rates, which means it's even harder to borrow. So there's going to be less liquidity in the local economy. And they are supposedly reversing their quantitative easing, which means they're selling back all those bonds that they bought. So they are returning the bonds, which is the debt, and taking back the money, which is going to tighten the liquidity in the local economy even more. So the money's just not there for people to pay off their debts, for starters, but also for consumers to consume, to buy all those products that we consider our productive economies. So overall, there's going to be not enough money to pay off all those debts. It's the nature of our debt-based economy anyway, that you have to keep increasing the money that's out there just to pay principal and interest on loans that created money in the first place, where more is owed back than was created in the original loan. So you've got to keep expanding the money supply. And although they may say the money supply has been expanding, like with quantitative easing, that money has not gone into the local economy. It's gone into stocks and speculation of various sorts. It's gone into real estate, of course, and driven up those prices. So it's gone into asset and price inflation, not into the pockets of workers, who are the people that you need to be out there shopping if you want to have a consumer economy. I mean, true, if you put money in their pockets today, they're going to be spending their money in China. The Chinese that are going to get the money, but that's okay. That just means we can put more and more money out there, and we're still not going to inflate our money system. So what we could do is we could void out the student debt, for example. There was a very recent study showing that you could cancel all student debt, and it would stimulate the economy, and it would not significantly affect the federal debt or inflation. But the thing is, there are various ways that you could and should, and it would be good to get more money into the local economy, just with quantitative easing or qualitative easing, whatever you want to call it. Put money out there for infrastructure and student loans and maybe a basic income guarantee. There are various ways you could get money out there, but we need more money in the local economy. That would not drive up prices. It would just make a market economy. It would make a market.
The researchers found that a cancellation of student debt would have a meaningful stimulus effect, characterized by greater economic activity as measured by GDP and employment, with only moderate effects on the federal budget deficit, interest rates, and inflation, while the state budgets improve, all of which suggests that policies that student debt cancellation can be a viable part of a needed reorientation of U.S. higher education. Yeah, let's get people out from underneath the debt trap so that we can have a viable and vital economy instead of having to all be debt slaves in line. This is really a time for a breakthrough, Alan. I think that the public banking work that we're involved here is certainly a leading edge in opening the conversation about why banking needs to be a utility, a public utility, like water and electricity, rather than a parceled out commodity.
Like gold and silver, that's what people think of as money, as a thing, but it's today money is not a thing. It's zeros and ones, it's debits and credits, it comes and goes. So it's not a thing, it's a flow, and a flow is liquidity. It's a thing that connects people, flows between people, like electricity and roads, energy.
And love.
These are things that connect people. Money connects people, and these are things that should be publicly regulated, but we've seen that regulating the private banks is not sufficient. It doesn't work to be publicly owned.
The way we relate to each other monetarily has a lot to do with the values we care to espouse and protect and the means through which we can realize them. Our next guest, Ivan Frischberg from Amalgamated Bank, demonstrates how banking can serve a public function even though it's privately owned. It's a very interesting tale, I thought.
Right. It would be all according to your business model, how you set up your charter.
Well, let's go talk to him, Ellen.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
You've heard us rail about the self-serving irresponsibility of the big private banks that ignore the need for funding of public needs and how they focus on profiteering over public service. Well, not all big private banks are the same, and today we're pleased to introduce you to one of the really good ones that for the past 100 years has been focusing on providing financing for a wide assortment of public needs and public investment. Our guest is Ivan Frischberg, the first vice president of sustainability banking for Amalgamated Bank.
One of the things that really fascinated us about what you're doing in the general category of banking, you know, our public bank mission is focused on public service and public interest. We call it banking in the public interest. And that little catchphrase speaks a lot, both in terms of both need and also hopes that people around the country have to make something better about how we invest and how much we can invest in public interest affairs. Here you are at a private bank doing the kind of work that we think is frontline critical investing. So I'd like to get a sense from you about Amalgamated past, you know, where it's coming from, what its commitments are, and then what it is that you're doing. Where did Amalgamated Bank come from, when, and what's it been up to?
We were started almost 100 years ago, so we've been around for quite a while. And we were started by a textile workers union in New York City. And it was a very simple proposition at that time for the labor union, which is they had a bunch of workers, many of whom were migrant workers, and were not able to access the kind of mainstream banking system. And so they were able to create a bank and set up a bank that would serve their workers and their families. And so from that beginning, we've been sort of a bank that has been focused on serving working people and workers and progressive values since that time. And we did more than just provide regular banking service, but we were the bank that first developed a system for migrant workers in the U.S. to send money back home to their families that might still live overseas. We were the first to do unsecured consumer credit to working people. We've kind of come from a tradition of really figuring out how a bank can play a role to make people's lives better. And since that time, we've kind of held true to our values, but we've also grown into a bank that is more broadly a national bank. So first of all, we're not just New York anymore. We have clients in 48 states and work not just with labor unions, but with environmental groups, with political campaigns, with social advocacy organizations, philanthropies and charities, a whole network of both institutions and workers and families and individuals that really, you know, come to us because we share some of the values that they have about making this world a better place.
So is the bank worker-owned?
We are owned by, principally or majority owned by a labor union, Workers United.
Okay, a labor union, yeah. But not necessarily the, it's not a cooperative in the sense of the workers of the bank own the bank.
No, that's right. It's through the employees and the members of the union.
One issue we have is, with a public bank, people are always saying, well, you're going to lose money if you do all these public interest type things. You've got to do the things that will make money. How do you, protect against risk, and how do you balance doing good with actually being profitable and serving your shareholders and so forth?
We don't find that there's actually a trade-off there. There's an enormous world of people who are out there doing good, seeking to make the world a better place, and they need banking services. And they need banking services just because they got to keep their money somewhere overnight, or because they're trying to start some new campaign or a new advocacy effort, or have a building to work from that they own, or any number of other reasons why people need banking services. And we think there's plenty of opportunities out there to go out and do good, straightforward, some might call it boring banking. You know, we're not making bad, risky decisions. We're not just giving away money or anything like that. But we're attentive to, and we understand our clients' needs. A lot of our team at the bank come from the kind of core of the banking industry, but a lot of us come from the world of our clients, working at foundations or working at environmental groups, working on political campaigns or labor unions. And so we understand how our clients' industries and communities work. And so we're able to serve them well to return a profit to the bank, and then also make sure that we're helping those people who are doing good do even better.
So you're making money. As a bank, you're in the black.
Yes, we are. I mean, we're privately held for-profit corporation. So, you know, it's not, this isn't a charitable enterprise, but we think that there's if we're in this mission together, then the prosperity that can come from working together should be shared, you know, on both sides of the equation. So we donate a lot and return a lot to the communities that we serve. We return a profit, but we work really hard to make sure that we're helping our clients meet their missions.
When you look at the horizon of lending, how is Amalgamated looking at its future? Is this an agenda and or its services starting to change at all to target special customer bases or categories of customers?
Yeah, certainly we're not the same bank that we were 100 years ago or 50 years ago or even 10 years ago. We're evolving. A good example of that is even the position that I'm in at the bank, leading up our sustainability banking practice. That was a new position a couple of years ago. We have been building out to support more solar companies and more in the environmental community. And we've actually just before the end of the year announced that we're going to be joining forces with New Resource Bank, which is a smaller San Francisco-based bank that is highly focused on the sustainability side of things and has a 10-year track record of solar lending and real expertise in that space. And so that's one of the things where we're going to be able to grow out and do even more of that type of work. And there's a couple of advantages of doing that sort of thing. The first is that we're and help more solar companies, create more jobs, put more solar panels up, get more schools and churches and affordable housing developments to go solar. But then we're also taking the folks who just leave their money in the bank and they need a safe place to keep their cash. And what we're essentially doing is instead of just letting that money sit there, we're going out and making sure that it goes to do something really special and good. Something that they believe in. So we believe that beyond just giving somebody an interest rate for the money they might keep in the bank, we're giving them an impact in the community or the world that they live in.
I think it's really terrific that you're filling that gap, because the rest of the banking industry doesn't seem to be as interested in that, from what I gather. So you're filling a much-needed vacuum, and you're saying it's a profitable sort of a framework for that?
Yeah, we're actually not alone. There's a couple of different networks of banks that are committed to this sort of same social good. One is the banks that are part of B Corp, which is a network of corporations that are committed to providing public benefit. And they are highly screened and have to go through a pretty intensive vetting process to make sure that everything from, you know, how they treat their employees and how they are on the environment and all of, you know, a whole range of social, environmental, governance criteria, that these are companies that are truly not just saying they're doing a few good things, but are actually across the board acting as a what they refer to as sort of public benefit corporation. And so there's a number of not just banks that are in the B Corp network, all sorts of businesses are, Ben & Jerry's, Patagonia, you can get down to much smaller organizations, but that also includes a whole number of banks. The other network is the Global Alliance for Banking on Values, which is really a network dedicated to just banks both here in the U.S. and around the world that have a very concrete vision of what it means to be a values-based bank. And so we're part of that movement. We're one of the larger institutions, or the largest in the United States, that are part of that effort. But collectively, I think all of us share the idea that there's a better way to do banking to serve customers who share those kind of beliefs and vision of what the world could be.
So you mostly, in the way of loans, you're mostly doing business loans to businesses that are doing sustainable public interest type things. Is that correct? I mean, you're not doing housing loans.
Actually, we do a lot of real estate housing, both residential mortgages as well as tenant occupied real estate. We do a wide range of lending. We also do a lot of lending to nonprofits. We do some lending to CDFIs or community development financial institutions. So we have a pretty broad portfolio of the types of loans that we do.
I'm just finishing up a book on the coming revolution in banking. So I did a chapter on India and these revolutionary things they're doing in India. And I just saw an article where most of the banks in India are publicly owned. So this article was about, in defense of the public banks, apparently there's a big push to privatize them because they're not as profitable as the private banks. And I guess there was one big public bank that was caught in some sort of corruption. So anyway, this article in defense of public banks said the reason they're not so profitable is they're taking on most of the population in India are very poor farmers. These are people that before the nationalization of the banks just simply could not get credit. And so they're taking on the hard projects, like the infrastructure projects and the servicing the general poorer population, which is most of the population. So the private banks that are doing well are allowed to and do limit themselves to the very profitable businesses, the business loans, and they're speculators, and when they speculate well, of course, they do well, but there are many private banks, I guess they have hundreds of private banks that have gone bankrupt, and he pointed out that in the West, the speculating private banks actually brought down the whole economy and cost the taxpayers a lot of money bailing them out, and they've been caught in far more corruption than public banks. Anyway, I just thought that was an interesting take on it, that, I mean, it's interesting that you can do a public interest oriented sort of business and still be quite profitable.
Absolutely. And every bank, I think, has these kind of tensions where, on the one hand, we have important federal requirements, CRA, that say, you have to serve everybody in the community that you're involved with, and you can't redline and you can't cherry pick your clients and you need to do a certain amount of banking that is tailored to those who are most at risk of not having banking services, right? So, you know, we have rules around that. And then by the same token, we have regulators who are saying, you know, that look at everything any bank does to make sure that they're being smart about what they're doing, and that they're not just throwing good money after bad or presenting a risk to shareholders, the banking system. And you can see what, you know, what happens when we go astray of that, as you mentioned, in terms of the last big hit to the economy, because we were chasing a lot of bad debt. So I think, you know, the tensions are around throughout the banking system around that. I think the difference is when you're really focused on a community that you know, that you're a part of, you understand the impact that you're having, and you kind of focus your banking in that way. It may be boring. It may not deliver the kind of epic shareholder returns that one of the top five U.S. banks might want to present back to shareholders, the kind of returns that come from big global deals. But that's a pretty safe and profitable space for banks to serve the communities that they represent. And let me just say that I don't mean just a geographic community, because that's one way to look at it. Communities in this day and age obviously extend beyond that to include values-based communities, trades and professions and shared interests. You know, there are banks that just serve trial lawyers, right, that understand that profession, the unique needs there, and have developed a way of working within that community. Silicon Valley Bank represents by its name, a geography, but really it has an expertise around banking startups and the tech community. And so in doing that in a way that most other banks, frankly, probably couldn't do. And so that point of really being connected to a specific community and focused on their needs ends up being, I think, both a smart, safe banking enterprise, but also a profitable one.
So sustainable banking, the notion of sustainable banking suggests a business model that is sustainable, but is it referring to that, or is it referring to the kinds of investments that you're making specifically?
It refers to the clients that we serve just on the commercial banking level. So we have a lot of great environmental groups that rely on us for commercial banking services. We have a lot of solar companies that we work with. I also work with our investment management division on the sustainability side of our portfolio of investments that we manage on behalf of our clients. So we have a carbon-free product that we serve some clients for, you know, where they want to go be divested. We can do that, screen investments in all sorts of different ways. So I work kind of across the bank, but with that focus on sustainability.
I noticed that the Norwegian Sovereign Fund, which I think is the world's largest, is pulling out of oil and gas. That was one of your targets, one of your focuses recently when we met. Is that true for Amalgamated, too? I mean, you're doing things to move against investment in those industries.
Yeah, I came to the bank with a passion around climate change and a concern around climate change, and that's where the history of my work had been, and that interest was shared by the leadership of the bank. And so over the course of the first year that I was here, we made a few decisions. One was to ensure that none of our own assets, we can't control everything that our, you know, choices that our clients are making, but within our assets, we were going to be divested of climate risk. And so there are projects that we will not support now because of that. So that's one thing. The second thing, and what it practically means is that if you are leaving your money with us overnight or for a longer period of time, that you feel you can be completely confident that we're not sending that money out the door in the form of a loan or a transaction that's going to help somebody build some fossil fuel infrastructure that might go against your concerns around climate change. The second thing we did is say that we would be 100% renewable energy. So over the course of this year, we've operationalized that and fully switched over to clean energy contracts. And then for any of the emissions that we can't control, so some of the buildings we're in require natural gas. that's how they're not buildings we own, but that's how they're heated or for some travel and the emissions that come from that. We are purchasing offsets so that we will be net zero carbon as a bank in terms of our emission profile year over year.
That is so impressive. You know, it's just, it's inspiring to hear about a bank, Amalgamated Bank in this case, taking a strong stand and an operational stand in favor of those things that people really want. I mean, we're hearing that in the cities around the country. In Los Angeles, for example, a group of public banking people there approaching city council and getting their support of saying, we want to get out of the dirty fuel industry. And here you are doing that on your own initiative. Do you serve or do you serve any municipalities or states with their banking needs?
A little bit. It is very hard to be the kind of core banker for any kind of decent sized municipality, just because of the size of their needs. And you know, we're a pretty healthy $4 billion bank, but we could not serve as the kind of core bank New York City or Washington D.C. But we do provide some services to municipalities. Certainly, we do on the investment side and pension side, where we're very proud to be the, you know, custodian or asset manager for some of the investment work that they're doing.
I'm very interested in hearing more about how the pension side works from your investment approach. Can you characterize what you guys invest in for pension funds, or is it just a general fund?
We're not doing direct investing or fancy type things. You know, we do index funds that are screened. We do a lot of shareholder advocacy and activism with the proxy votes that we have, but it's investing in the market. So the low carbon or carbon-free account that we have is benchmarked against the Russell 3000, and it looks very much like the Russell 3000, except for it doesn't have those companies identified by the Carbon Underground 200 as being the largest carbon asset holders. So that's the kind of work that we do. I will say, just sort of returning to an earlier point of yours, those kind of products, or whether it's going solar in our branches, those are all things that we think our clients are excited about. But we're beyond the point now where there's a trade-off. Those are good business decisions. You know, when we went solar at the building that we own, and we're in the process of taking some of the leased properties that we have and helping them to go solar, that's all going to return value to the bank very quickly. And so those are not just doing good for the environment and reducing air pollution, but they're actually helping to return to our bottom line as well.
It's just impressive to me, and I'm sure there are a lot of people who are listening who would like to get their money into your bank. Is that a possibility? Can people create personal accounts with you wherever they are around the country?
Absolutely. Amalgamatedbank.com. We do retail accounts. We do commercial accounts. We have a great service team and relationship managers, particularly working, you know, with our commercial clients. So if you have a nonprofit or campaign or anything like that, we provide great service. If you're looking for retail banking where you are going to depend, especially in a kind of the new online environment where you want to bank through a mobile app and you want to bank online, and sort of we have all the services to be able to support that, and you can get that all through amalgamatedbank.com. And if you have mortgage and lending needs, there's ways to access that through the website as well.
In terms of the banking industry itself, we're very familiar with a long string of violations and offenses. Would you characterize an endemic problem in the banking industry? I mean, what's native to banking that's not working, in your view, in the standard industry?
I don't know that this is actually unique to banking, but there's something that comes along with size that can often create a trade-off for a company when you get super, super huge, right? It is easy to sacrifice the kind of service that you had before, but it also, when you become so big, your profits have to become bigger, and not all of these things scale in the same way. And so you start to do things to keep up those returns to shareholders and to keep up profitability and compete with the other large institutions, and sometimes those really big things are the ones that can take you off course. I mean, I think to a pretty significant extent, you know, that was true with the housing crisis that we referenced earlier. I think it's also true with the projects like the Dakota Access Pipeline, where you have dozens of banks throwing in $300, $400, or $500 million into a syndicated loan venture, you know, because it's profitable. That's a, you know, you're joining with others, you're doing underwriting once, and you're moving, you know, maybe even $500 million out the door as a transaction, and you're getting some profits for that. That's an easier way for a big bank to make money than going out and making, you know, 100,000 smaller loans to small businesses or community organizations, right? And so I think sometimes size and the mandate to deliver short-term profits, you know, at that scale kind of often take any industry, it's not just banks, any industry, into doing things that maybe they wouldn't otherwise do.
Yeah, that's a great answer, by the way. I think that, you know, the tendency to want to maximize any opportunity of profit, overriding the values that are inherent in those investments, is it's a common problem for sure. Well, Ivan, thank you very much for the time. And from a public banking perspective, we trust that we'll be working together in some of these markets and on some of these projects. You sound like a great partner for the public interest. And perhaps we'll find a way for a new type of collaboration to develop.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Walt. Thank you, Ellen.
That's Ivan Frischberg, First Vice President for Sustainability Banking with Amalgamated Bank. And now we look at another kind of public service bank, a community development financial institution. Our guest is Wayne Lau, the executive director of the Rainier Valley Community Development Financial Institution outside of Seattle. Wayne has been on the front lines of community lending as a community banker and now in this position with Rainier Valley's CDFI. We ask him what a CDFI is.
Yes, well, a CDFI stands for Community Development Financial Institution. It is a designation that you can call yourself that as long as you are a nonprofit and engaged in community development, although I do know that credit unions are can be CDFIs also. And they, of course, are nonprofit, but they're not quite in the same way. The official designation was set up by the U.S. Treasury, and we, in fact, are a certified CDFI that you have to go through the U.S. Treasury, the federal, you know, the national or the federal government to get that certification, and certain resources are available in terms of funding, either in the form of grants or loans to CDFIs to do their local community work. It's all about making investments and lending to, again, designated local communities. It could be supporting business, it could be supporting even individual financial people who do not have access to traditional banking products. And the other thing is to encourage home ownership. It also is to fund affordable housing, and that's really defined as housing which is affordable to those that are at a median income for that area or below, because those are sometimes very difficult for them to either get rental housing or sale, you know, for sale ownership housing, given the price of markets now and so forth. So CDFIs are engaged in all of those things, but it is very local focused, and again, in the name, it means community development financing.
Right. And where do you get your money? Where do CDFIs get their money?
Well, mainly three different sources. One is, as I mentioned, you know, through the U.S. Treasury, you can get both grant and a long-term, very low-rate loan. We have been successful in getting that for, you know, this last, actually, 2017 funding round, which, of course, that budget was set by the prior administration, although we're not sure about going forward with the new administration budget 2018 and beyond, whether that, you know, how much money, we've heard that it will be available for the CDFIs. It is a competitive process, so just because you apply doesn't mean every CDFI will get it, you know, so that's one source. The other source would be getting a actual line of credit from a bank. There are some national banks are quite active in providing these kinds of funding. They tend to be in the form of a loan at you know, somewhere in the prime rate or maybe a little bit below prime. And so we re-lend it out, of course, as a intermediary in that sense. You know, the interest rates will be a little bit higher because we have to make a spread over what we're borrowing it from the banks. And then the third source would be other foundations, other normal charitable organizations and so forth that may give either loans or outright grants. So those are our three funding sources for CDFI, where we get our capital to do our community development work.
The federal budget, then, does it have any impact on you at all?
Well, the federal budget itself, we can't determine that yet on CDFIs because we, you know, there's a strong emphasis on infrastructure and so forth, but then there are also cuts in other areas. We're not real clear, if we're talking about housing specifically, we're not clear what the budget is going to be for HUD, you know, the Housing and Urban Development, which does a lot of the funding for community development projects as well as housing. So it's not very clear, you know, how those dollars are going to be allocated and how aggressive HUD is going to be under the current, Secretary, Ben Carson, how aggressively he wants to push that money out, for communities and what the priorities are going to be, because, you know, everything is going to be based on priorities, you know, of the administration.
Hasn't Secretary Carson indicated that he doesn't think that subsidized housing is a good principle to pursue?
Yeah, I'm not aware of that. And the other thing is we do know that, you know, their most well-known program for HUD is what they call Section 8 housing assistance. That type of subsidy for which is paid directly to landlords, you know, of, you know, you have to apply for the Section 8 housing. That's always been very difficult to get. It depends on which area of the country, but, you know, so I'm not going to necessarily fault the current administration for making it even more difficult, because it's always been, a very difficult thing for a home, for a renter to get those Section 8 subsidies. There's just a long waiting list for those. However, again, what's unclear is, like what we call a community block grants, which, our organization had a big community block grant funded through the city of Seattle with us back in 2003 and 2004. Those kind of fundings are getting very, very difficult to get for cities, and we're not sure what the allocation of dollars are going to be going into the future. But again, those dollars, it's highly competitive amongst cities, and of course, certain political, municipalities are going to have an even tougher time based on, maybe their political stance on certain issues like immigration and sanctuary cities and so forth. Because I think there's going to be a game, a little game played here between winners and losers, in terms of getting federal dollars for those types of things. I know there are some political pressures on those cities which consider themselves, sanctuary cities. And again, that's more related to the whole immigration issue as opposed to community development or housing or anything like that.
Yes, so the federal government is using another unrelated issue, immigration, to affect how it dispenses access to capital and for efficacious financing. It's been said that the federal low-income housing tax credit
Congress created in its last major tax package under Ronald Reagan, generated about credit for building about 2 million affordable housing units, and made it very possible for made it more possible for low-cost housing to be a viable a destination for investment. And now it sounds like that may also be cut, or at least undercut, by other tax policy. So when you look at community development resources, your CDFI fills a very specific, very and needed sort of a role. But do you see what ways in which housing could be better addressed? Are there some ideas that you have about how we can support people in lower income or lower middle income places to be able to acquire property? Or are we just looking at a nation of renters moving forward?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because those are two issues that it really depends on the locality, you know, whether the policy is to try to encourage more home ownership or to have renting, you know, have more rentals, affordable rentals available. For example, in, you know, the Pacific Northwest, and I'm really speaking of both Seattle and Portland, which are very similar in their housing markets, the stress or the pressure really is to provide more affordable rental housing. The whole issue of home ownership, you know, I mean, there used to be incentives for home ownership, with the deductibility of mortgage interest. However, now they are cutting that, and it really affects more high-priced homes. You know, they're cutting it from $1 million to $750,000, the deductibility. But what that also does is when you lower the overall tax rates for everyone, it makes the feature of interest deductibility less attractive, you know, when you compare that, because now it doesn't really matter if you're not itemizing and you're just taking a standard deduction. So, you know, it remains to be seen how that is going to affect property values as far as single family homes and condominiums. However, it the one main thing that it's the tax cut policy is going to affect is the value of the low-income housing tax credits, you know, what we call LIHTC credits, because most affordable housing developers rely very heavily on the sale of tax credits to generate what we call the equity, you know, to put into these projects. I know in the state of Washington here, there's a very heavy reliance on low-income housing tax credits. With the cut in the tax rate, and I think you've referenced certain articles and analyses having to do with the corporate tax rate from 35 to, you know, down to like 21%, the value of those tax credits, goes way down. And a lot of people don't realize how these things, but when a project or an affordable housing developer comes up with a project, they do their pro forma based on a sale of certain amount of tax credits there so that they can get that upfront equity to do the project. Well, if, you know, and there's a market in these, it's all determined by, you know, it's a truly open market, supply and demand for that. With the cut in the tax rate, your investors, which tend to be a lot of times it's banks and so forth, that now they're finding that their corporate tax rate is way down. They're not willing to pay as much for these tax credits as prior to the cut. So what that means is that with affordable housing developers, they're going to not get the amount of equity that they have to put into a project, and they're going to have to rely a lot more on whether it's a housing authorities in a city, which certain states have housing authorities to have a loan fund, or in the case of the city of Seattle, they're going to have to rely on a special levy, which the city of Seattle has had, and the city it's going to be going out again. But what it basically does it puts an increasing tax burden on the property owners in the municipality. So with the tax credit value having gone down, they're just going to be a lot more difficult to, you know, to raise that kind of money to do the affordable housing tax, the projects.
Is that something that you think a public bank would be able to assist, help alleviate this paucity of funding?
Yeah, I think where I see the public banks coming in is to, and really it's not so much having to do with the tax policy, because they can't really control, because they're not going to be a taxable entity. It's going to be, you know, a public entity. But where it will come in is that they can be a little bit more aggressive in the debt financing of affordable housing projects. As I said, a lot of other municipalities or areas or states are really relying on housing finance commissions and the city finance commissions and housing authorities to provide the financing. And that's not going away. I mean, that's there. However, these financing vehicles are not as aggressive in providing the sufficient funding to do these kinds of projects. And so what I see from a public banking standpoint is that instead of these funds going to a Wall Street type bank and so forth, and that the public bank can use these deposit funds to then directly invest in these affordable housing projects. And we're really mainly talking about rental projects, you're building anywhere from 40, 50 units to maybe several hundred units. That takes a tremendous amount of financial capital. And right now, of course, certainly most cities are very limited in terms of how much they can devote to that kind of financing. And the only way to really get that kind of revenue is through local property tax or levies. It would be good to have a public bank available that can channel some additional monies into this particular field, and that is something I think that will have a lot of if that's in the policy of that particular city or the state or county or whatever, if that's in their policy to try to make more affordable housing available, then they should use that vehicle of the public bank to make those loans, because I'll tell you, the private sector is definitely not going to do it.
That's Wayne Lau, the Executive Director of the Rainier Valley CDFI. And finally, an insightful historic look at Hamilton with Bob Bowes.
As unlikely as it may seem to most people, the hottest theater ticket in cities across North America is to a musical about the first Secretary of the Treasury of the United States, Alexander Hamilton. With the arrival of the musical here in Colorado, as Billy Graham's body lies in state in the Capitol Rotunda in D.C., the structural resemblance to propaganda in the Elizabethan age via the stage and pulpit is too obvious to ignore. Even the New York Times has allowed a glimpse of this strategy to find its way into its print and digital editions. Take this excerpt from its article, What Hamilton Forgets About Hamilton. Quote, the musical avoids a pronounced feature of Hamilton's beliefs, his deeply ingrained elitism, his disdain for the lower classes, and his fear of democratic politics. End quote. This admission that Hamilton was a royalist and elitist makes him no different than George Washington and a host of others at the time. However, the Times article goes on to reveal the central misrepresentation of the Hamilton script. Quote, one of the musical's most memorable scenes portrays Hamilton's debate with Thomas Jefferson over the establishment of a national bank. What it doesn't convey is Jefferson's populist resistance to an economic plan that, in his view, supported the rule of commercial oligarchs who manipulated credit and currency at the expense of debtors and yeoman farmers. End quote. What the authors hint at but do not detail is that Hamilton sold the fledgling nation back to the same British bankers whose mercenaries the colonists had just defeated on the battlefield via his First Bank of the United States. In other words, he was a traitor. So what is the larger strategy of the powers that be that is revealed in their investment in this entertaining piece of propaganda? The Times explains this in another article entitled, quote, Hamilton may stay on the $10 bill thanks to help from Broadway, end quote, where we are told most emphatically that the musical has derailed the plan to replace Hamilton's visage on our currency. Instead, the portrait of Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill will be replaced, quote, because of his Indian Removal Act, which forced Native Americans out of their territories and led to the Trail of Tears, end quote. Another reason given for Jackson's removal is that he was a notorious slaver. But all of this, slaveholder and advocate of Native American genocide, puts him in the same category as Washington and Jefferson, who will remain on our currency. So why is Jackson being singled out? This strategy of using the public stage as a platform for changing history began in earnest in 2009 with the Broadway production of Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson. Just as the musical Hamilton ignores the title character's role in selling out the United States of America to European bankers, so too does Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson ignore the seventh president's principal role in ending the charter of the Second Bank of the United States while calling the banking cartel vipers. This combination of theatrical and religious propaganda by the powers that be is a long-standing historical tradition, a prime example being the Elizabethan age. In 1586, when England was 2 years into the official war with Spain and bracing for King Philip's invasion, the Queen signed a warrant granting Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, an extraordinary allowance of £1,000 per year, the third greatest in the kingdom. One might wonder why a poet and dramatist who employed a variety of pen names and allonyms, including William, Shake, Hyphen, Spear, to hide his nobility, a code to which most of his class adhered, would receive a grant by a queen in desperate need of cash to fight Spain. The answer is simple. Elizabeth employed the 17th Earl of Oxford to write a series of history plays that justified Tudor rulership and rallied patriotic citizens to Britain's cause, as well as to write anonymous homilies for the pulpit, which served the same purpose. Today we see the same strategy on the part of the powers that be, with false history of Hamilton making the rounds as the body of an evangelist lying in state in the capital of a nation whose principles include the separation of church and state. With corporate control over church and state, history becomes nothing more than a public relations strategy. Education becomes nothing more than propaganda, and traitors who work for the Anglo-Euro-American banking cartel and its corporations are painted as heroes. It matters not which political party brand, blue or red, they represent. The same folks pull the puppet strings. So if you choose to pay hundreds of dollars to go see Hamilton and soak in the best spectacle that money can buy, remember, the history being presented comes with a very specific and insidious agenda. This is Bob Bowes.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money!